fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Shalom, shalom. Welcome to the program. It is Wednesday, is January the 5th, 2022. So glad to talk to you. And you can call in 1-888-914-9149, toll free to talk to me live on the Cale Clark Show. If you have a question, call it in 1-888-914-9149. You can also email the program, Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. And you can also tweet at me. You can grab onto my Twitter handle, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And you can also access the show account, at Cale Clark Show. And producer Lucas, today is also the feast day, if I'm not mistaken, of St. John Neumann, right?
That's right, yeah.
Not to be confused with St. John Henry Newman.
Right.
Right, so I guess we could say hello.
Spelled differently.
Hello, Neumann. Yeah, so it's spelled a little differently. So two different guys. A lot of people get confused about that. And there's certainly a lot of people who are confused in the culture. Isn't that the case? And over the holidays, I came across a piece by an opinion writer for the New York Times named Christopher Caldwell. And the article was entitled, "Is Paganism Back in the West? Has the West Become Pagan Once Again?" And he wrote a book called The Age of Entitlement, America Since the 60s, Christopher Caldwell. So he actually mentions something that we had talked about on the program prior to Christmas. And I know it's still Christmas, but you get the point before the break. There was a Pew Research Center poll that was done on religion in America, and we had talked about how, you know, a lot of Americans don't believe in an eternal hell anymore, or heaven for that matter. One of the things that this poll said was that at this point, there are only slightly more Americans who are Catholics, 21%, than believers in quote-unquote nothing in particular. In other words, the nuns, the so-called nuns of society. So Roman Catholics, 21%, and the nuns are 20%. So this is kind of an overall stat, so the numbers are getting a little bit tighter. But when it comes to the millennials, and of course the millennials are everybody under 40 in America, Christians are a minority in that age group. So Christopher Caldwell started asking the question, is America really less religious than it used to be? Is America becoming more pagan? And he mentions this book that created a big stir this past fall. And it was written by a French political theorist by the name of Chantal Del Sol. And she talks about the fact that we are living through the end of Christian civilization, or the end of Christendom. A lot of people have said this. This isn't necessarily a new idea. But she sort of states that Christian civilization, as it were, began with the 4th century conversion of Constantine the Emperor. Pagans, the official religion of the empire, of course, became Catholicism. And of course, Constantine himself held off his baptism to the last possible minute because he thought, I might have some more sinning to do here. That's a bad way to look at it for sure. But the Romans routed all the pagan holdouts in the late 4th century. And Chantal Del Sol, this French political writer, says that Christendom kind of ended, in her view, when Pope John the 23rd embraced religious pluralism. I don't recall that actually ever happening. But anyway, so that's probably some reference to a misunderstanding about Vatican II. But she thinks that the Christian civilization ended with John the 23rd's embrace of religious pluralism. And again, I don't think that actually happened. And the West's legalization of abortion, which we know did happen for sure. It's had horrific consequences in society. So this book by this French writer, Chantal Del Sol, is called La Fin de la Chrétienté. La Fin de la Chrétienté. So all those years of taking French classes in school, which I had to do growing up in Canada because that's our second language, it just paid off for you there, folks. And what is the title of this book in English? You could translate it as The End of the Christian World. The End of the Christian World. So what she's saying is that the Christian faith is not going to end. The Catholic Church will obviously remain until Christ returns. But she says that Christian culture is pretty much done. And what does she mean by Christian culture? She means that the way that mostly Christian societies were governed, all kinds of art, philosophy, sort of the cultural ambiance, if you will, that kind of grew up under the influence of the faith. And as Christopher Caldwell says in the New York Times, that's actually a lot of stuff. That's a lot of stuff that's being removed because, man, if you look at the West, all of our cultural norms are really based off of Christianity. The general sense of morality that's in the culture, obviously that's under attack with all the culture wars that are going on. But she apparently it's an interesting book because she engages with people in a very, I guess you could say, a very ironic way. Like it's a model for dialogue in a postmodern world. But her approach is actually kind of interesting because what she does apparently is she looks at the way civilization is changing now with rejecting Christianity with the way that it became the dominant religion of the time 1600 years ago. So she called it, when Christians brought the faith to pagan Rome, she called it a normative inversion. It was kind of, the world was flipped upside down in a certain sense. Because Christians were very fond of and prized a lot of things that the Romans hated. And Christians also condemned things that the Romans prized, that they loved, particularly in matters related to sexuality and the family, because there was a lot of immorality in the pagan Roman world. But in a sense, what's happening today is almost the polar opposite. We're inverting what happened 1600 years ago. We are re-paganizing. We are re-paganizing. Not us in the church, but this is what's going on in the culture. It's a re-paganization. And I thought that was a striking term. Now, by the way, in terms of what paganism actually means, because a lot of people are confused about the definition. If you call somebody a pagan, it's usually considered pretty insulting. Oh, you pagan. And you're listening to the K.L. Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 1-888-914-9149. There was never an actual dictionary definition necessarily for paganism, but it was basically anybody who wasn't a Catholic, anybody who rejected divine revelation, and that could be polytheists, it could be people who worshipped Mother Earth. We still have those people today, nature worshipers, agnostics. They kind of get into this catch-all umbrella of paganism. And the word pagus referred to the countryside. And so the Latin word paganus really is very similar to the English word heathen. So there's a note of contempt there, as Christopher Caldwell says. There's a note of contempt towards the non-religious. And it kind of has this connotation of hillbillies or hicks or just people who are ignorant, who just don't know. Now, it's kind of the opposite because very often right now, people of religion are considered ignoramuses, people that just don't know, who believe in some flying spaghetti monster. You've heard probably the caricatures of Christians that have been passed around the culture today. And if you find this New York Times article, if you just look at the comments, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. There's a lot of hate on, of course, for the church. And some of it is self-inflicted. I mean, the scandals that have happened in recent years in the church haven't exactly been motives of credibility for us. But that doesn't take away from the historical facts of the life, death, miracles, ministry, and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. But we have to admit, though, and this is something that that comes through in the article, that the pagan culture of Rome had its merits. There were pagan artists, there were intellectuals in Rome before Christianity really took root, who did have some interesting things to say. Like I think about Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor, and if you've never read his stuff, he was into Stoicism. Probably seen Gladiator with Russell Crowe. You know, he's kind of presented as this wise guy. And one of the things that Christopher Caldwell says in the article is that paganism in Rome, okay, when the faith took over, when Catholicism took over, paganism couldn't be simply scolded and shamed out of existence. That's an interesting line. You can't shame it out of existence. And I think we have to take note of that as well. We can't do that with people in our lives as well that we're trying to attract to the faith. Shame on you for committing all these sins. That doesn't usually work. Angry, you know, placards and things like that. That's not the way to go. We need to attract people to the truth with goodness and beauty. And even people that disagree with us, we should be able to be friends with them and find some common ground with them, even if we disagree on essential matters. And if you can't build a friendship with somebody who doesn't believe the same way you do, there's not much chance you're going to be able to get the truth across to that person. Again, when you have a relationship with somebody, when you have a friendship with somebody, that friendship is like a bridge. And as you've heard me say before, you can't drive a truckload of truth across that bridge of friendship unless that bridge is strong enough to hold it, to sustain it. So very often we need to build these friendships over time with people so that there's trust. There's an element of personal trust and confidence so that when they are in a crisis, they might not be looking for God right now, but when they get into a crisis, they've lost their job, or say they come down with COVID, they start asking some serious questions about life, then they might turn to you. Oh, this guy is a person of faith, or this woman is a person of faith. Maybe I should talk to them. Maybe, and they'll know that they can trust you, and it's a safe place to have those conversations. So that's I think the key to the whole thing. But it's interesting that when the church kind of took over in, you know, about 1600 years ago as the dominant religion in the Roman Empire, they thought that, man, the pagans thought that Rome itself was going to collapse. I think Rome was on the verge of collapse anyways for a lot of other reasons, but Ms. Del Sol, who wrote this book, this French political theorist who wrote this book called The End of the Christian World, she says, well, you know, interesting, today's post-Christian world of quote-unquote progressivism, it comes actually with a large helping of Christianity on the side. So, I mean, there's various counterfeits, for example, of marriage that are out there in society, but they seem to always want to use the Christian basis of marriage to have their little ceremonies. Why do they do that? Because, again, Christianity is still kind of, you know, in the ether. It's in the air. So one of the things that the guy who wrote the article in the New York Times, Christopher Caldwell, says, if another civilization comes to replace Christianity, it will not be a mere negation. It will not be pure, like, we're not going to go into a society of pure atheism. It's going to be a rival civilization with its own logic, its own morality. And in France, where this lady comes from, Ms. Del Sol, who wrote the book, French commentators actually have a name for this. They call it le woke. You know, we've heard of people who are woke in today's culture. Well, in France, they call it le woke. And it means the same thing as it does in English, except in France, people actually look at wokeness as an American system from American universities that's been imported into Europe. And they look at it almost like its own religion. It's a religious doctrine. And when you think about speech codes, and this is the thing that got my fellow Canadian, Jordan Peterson, into the public eye a couple of years ago, because he refused to use gender pronouns that people wanted him to use. He refused to use terms like je or things like that. He would call them simply men and women. They had a problem with that. And he had a problem with what was called forced speech. He says, you can't compel me to use these pronouns. And that, so the speech codes, the way that a lot of corporations have bought into a lot of movements in society that we might say are antithetical to the faith, it's a little bit, this French writer, Ms. Del Sol, says that it's a little bit like what was going on in pagan Rome, where religion and morality were completely separated. Religion was a private thing, something you did in the household. But morality, what was the public morality, that was something that was, you were told to believe by the elites of society. And freedom of thought, forget about it. There was no such thing. Really interesting. So one of the things Just one last thing here, that apparently in the year AD 384, a lot of Catholics basically were successful in removing a pagan altar from the Roman Senate. Now, again, Christianity had become the official religion. So this pagan, it was called the Altar of Victory, was removed from the Roman Senate. Now, it had been there for four centuries. And there was a Roman pagan, a statesman by the name of Symmachus. And he said, you know what? Things are not going to turn out well for the pagans. He actually said, this is against common sense, this idea that there's only one path toward the great mystery. This should be rejected. How can these Catholics say there's only one true path? Well, we don't have much choice in that because that's what Jesus said. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. He didn't say that it wasn't possible for non-Christians to be saved, but if anybody is saved, it's because of Jesus Christ. And they'll figure that out in the afterlife. If they were searching for the truth as best as they knew and they had no opportunity to learn about Christianity, it wasn't their fault, then God takes that into consideration. But there is such a thing as truth, and we want to disabuse people of untrue notions. We want to set them free. The truth will set you free. That's what Jesus says. So, I don't know. I thought it was kind of interesting how we seem to be, as this French author argues, in kind of the flip side of the situation that was going on 1600 years ago. Society was flipped from a pagan to a Christian one almost overnight. And it seems like something that's happened, it happened gradually, of course, these ideas kind of filtered down from the elites to the man and woman on the street. But it seems like things have been flipped now, a little jujitsu. Now it seems like paganism is on the rise once again, the new paganism. So how do we respond to that? I think we need to respond to it the way that the first Christians responded to the pagan world in which they found themselves way before the Catholic Church became the official religion of the Roman Empire. And there were some downsides that came with that when it became the official religion. But how did the first Christians deal with being the minority in a pagan society that sought to kill them, that sought to eliminate them? I think that as we live through this new paganism and this post-Christian society in which we find ourselves, we can learn from these early Christians. We're going to talk about how we can do that after this quick break. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. If any of this is resonating with you, if you have a take on this, you can call in 888-914-9149. Be right back. Today's show is sponsored by Colby Academy. With more than 40 years of experience in Catholic home education, Colby Academy offers a blend of classical Catholic curriculum and the latest educational technology. More info at relevantradio.com/Colby.
This is The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Producer, nice job. Losing My Religion by REM. So we were talking before the break on The Cale Clark Show, and you can call in right now, 888-914-9149. We were talking before the break about an article that appeared in the New York Times, just on New Year's Eve, actually, and it was asking the question, has the West become pagan once again? And I think as Catholics, the way that we need to respond to this post-Christian new paganism is to respond like the first believers did in the pre-Christian world. And how did they live their faith when it was illegal, when worship was happening in the catacombs, near the tombs of the martyrs? The early Christians are a really, really good handbook for us today because there are a lot of parallels. There's a lot of overlap between their culture and ours. They lived in a very, very perverse world. Massive persecutions. Now, we haven't seen the kind of physical persecutions in the West that our brothers and sisters are seeing overseas, in places like India, Nigeria. If you're paying attention, the martyred church is still reality right now in the 21st century in different parts of the world. But in the first century, the church had no public buildings. There were no parish buildings that you could go to. St. Peter's in Rome didn't exist. Of course, the tomb of Peter was there, and that's they built it on top of that. But there were no public masses. There were no, you couldn't invite a friend of yours to go see Pope Linus in the Colosseum. Oh man, there's going to be an open air mass and he's going to be there in the Pope Mobile. No, most Catholics didn't even know who the Pope was because they didn't have Twitter. They didn't have Snapface and InstaChat. They didn't know what was going on in real time. It took a lot of time for word. First of all the early popes were martyred. The news of a new pope, it would take many, many months for news of that to get to the backwaters in the Roman provinces. But yet, even though they had no communication infrastructure, they had no public buildings, they were persecuted, yet the church grew at a rate of 40% per decade, which is astounding. It's an astounding rate of growth in the ancient world. So how did this faith spread if they couldn't do mass market evangelism? Well, they did, you know, mini market evangelism, I guess you could say, and they did it in a way that's a lot different from the way a lot of people do it today. They did it by the witness of their life, the witness of their personal lives. And there's a letter that was written in the second century, and it's called the Letter to Diognetus. It's a very famous early Christian document, and here's how this goes. This is really beautiful. And you can Google this. You can look this up later. It's called the Letter to Diognetus. And it says, as the soul is in the body, so Christians are in the world. The soul is dispersed throughout all the members of the body. Now think about that. In your body, anything that's alive has a soul. Even a plant has a plant soul. It's not an eternal soul, like our soul is created in the image of God. But every part of your body kind of has your soul in it, the animating principle, right? So just as the soul is in the body, so Christians are in the world. The soul is dispersed through all the members of the body, and Christians are scattered through all the cities of the world. The invisible soul is guarded by the visible body. And as Christians are known indeed to be in the world, their godliness remains invisible. So in other words, people couldn't sort of look at the situation with human eyes and figure out how this was happening because the early believers weren't doing anything weird. They weren't wearing, you know, massive crucifixes around their necks or anything like that. Here it goes on in the letter of Diognetus to say this: Christians are distinguished from others neither by country nor language nor the customs they observe. They neither inhabit cities of their own, which means that they basically didn't create kind of a Catholic ghetto, if you will, or a monastery type community. And of course, there is a place for those called to that life. There's no question about that. The rise of the monastic life came much later, but Catholics didn't say, you know, the world's going to hell in a handbasket. Let's build our own city over here, and we'll have this insular community. We'll all take care of ourselves, but, you know, we're just going to watch the world burn, you know, as the Joker wanted to do. No. That's not how they acted. They don't inhabit cities of their own, the letter says. They don't use a peculiar form of speech. They don't lead a life which is marked out by anything unusual. They inhabit Greek as well as barbarian cities. They don't abandon the quote-unquote pagan cities. Following the customs of the natives in respect to clothing, food, and the rest of their ordinary conduct, they display to us their wonderful and striking way of life. End of quote. So, in fact, pagans thought that there was some sort of weird magic going on. How in the world are they becoming so successful? This is not by any human means. Well, they were right, in a sense, because it wasn't happening naturally. It was happening supernaturally. Here's how Tertullian, who's an early church figure who lived in Africa, this is how Tertullian put it. He said, quote, "We began just yesterday." The church began, you know, basically just yesterday. It was just happened. "And already we fill the world and all your places, the cities, the islands, the towns, the municipalities, the councils, even the army camps, the tribunals, the assemblies, the palace, the senate, and the forum. We have left you only your temples," end of quote. And by that he meant the pagan temples. You can keep those, but we're everywhere. We're in the army barracks, we're in the places of commerce, We are the salt and light in every possible field. And so they simply had impact. There was salt, for salt to have impact, you got to have contact. It's like McDonald's fries, right? You don't just want to eat the flat fries plain. You want them to pour the salt on. Yeah, it's not good for you. But if you're going to have McDonald's, you might as well have the salt on the fries, right? That's what gives it the flavor. So if you don't get in touch with people that don't know Christ, how in the world are you going to present the gospel to them? So it's really the testimony of their lives, this friendship that they had, the confidence that people could have in them. They got to know them. And so people wanted what they had. And you had to get this. You couldn't just go to Mass even. You had to be initiated. You had to take catechism. You had to be a catechumen. And then after you were baptized, then you could partake in what they called the mysteries. And by that, they meant the sacraments, especially the sacrament of sacraments, the Eucharist. So that's what it's all about. And I think we can recapture that today in our own world. And Father Rocky Hoffman, the CEO of Relevant Radio, he gave all of us here at Relevant Radio a really inspirational talk today, where he talked about how, you know, we've got to use what's been known as the evangelical councils, if you will. And of course, if you are a member of a religious community, if you're a nun, if you're a religious brother, then you take vows for this stuff. Poverty, chastity, obedience. Now, for us, we don't take vows of these things, but they're still very, very good advice for us. They're good counsel. That's why they're called the evangelical councils. And it's a direct rebuke to what paganism values so highly. Poverty, chastity, and obedience are really the counterpoint to money, sex, and power. And by money, I mean greed. I don't mean money as a unit of commerce. I mean, money by itself is neutral. But the love of money, you know, the Bible, this is often misquoted. The Bible does not say that money is the root of all evil. It says the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, which is certainly true, because greed can get out there. And when it comes to sexuality, it's a gift of God that God created, but it has to be used within the channel that God provided, which is marriage between a man and a woman. And of course, power, the power in the church is power to serve. Jesus washed the feet of his apostles, the Lord of the universe. He's the cornerstone. He's at the bottom of the building, but he's holding the whole thing up. So it's downward mobility in the church, right? The higher you get, then in a sense, the more souls you're responsible for, and the more of a servant you have to be. That's what it's all about. That's the kind of thing that attracts people, because it's not a worldly use of power. And unfortunately, in times in church history, the church has given into worldliness. And that was part of the unfortunate trade-off, I guess you could say, of the church becoming the official religion of the Roman Empire, is open to power plays and people that were in it for the wrong reasons, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, Father Rocky had some interesting things to say, especially about the spirit of poverty, because one of the things he said is that, you know, when you live below your means, when you live the spirit of poverty, you're not driving around, you know, $500,000 vehicles and, you know, bling everywhere, like all sorts of ice around your neck. You know, even if you can afford it, it may not necessarily be the greatest idea, because living poverty of spirit kind of gives you credibility. This guy has some sort of, or this person has some sort of restraint. They're not indulging themselves. And maybe they can do it. Lord knows in the scriptures, there are lots of people who had resources, people like Nicodemus, people like, there's a government official who was a woman who helped provide for the needs of the apostles and part of Herod's cabinet, you know. And she believed in what the apostles were doing and put her resources at their disposal. There are people like Joseph of Arimathea. So they had resources, but they could be trusted with those resources because they didn't try to hoard them for themselves. They used them for the glory of God. So anyways, that's just a lot of stuff that we can say. I mean, we could go on and on about this, but just some stray thoughts on how we might kind of remind ourselves that in this post-Christian world, it's a lot like the pre-Christian world, so we should act like the Christians did in that early society. And I think the playbook is much the same. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call. You know, another thing that popped up in the New York Times, speaking of salvation, there's saving souls, there's saving bodies as well. We got to care for the whole person. At a hockey game, of all places, you might have heard of this story because this went viral. This was really a viral story, the save of a lifetime, literally. took place at a Seattle Kraken NHL hockey game. That's a new team, an expansion team, the Seattle Kraken. Release the Kraken. Do you have that audio, Lucas? Sorry. I was hoping you could find the Pirates of the Caribbean. But now the Seattle Kraken, it's a new NHL team. And I'm so glad they called them the Kraken. It's a cool logo, cool colors. The other option that for the contest for naming the team, it came down to the Seattle Kraken or the Seattle Sockeye. You know, obviously, sockeye salmon is plentiful in the region. Yeah, I guess it Rock'em Sock'em Hockey. I guess it could have been an apropos name, but I like the Kraken. The Kraken's cool. So having said that, there's a game that took place just a few days ago between the Kraken and the Vancouver Canucks, which are kind of a regional rival just up the coast. And this took place in Seattle. And a fan who was at the game, a 22-year-old prospective medical student, and her name is Nadia Popovici. It's actually Popovich, I think. Anyways, she was sitting behind the Vancouver Canucks bench. And she was pretty close to there. If you've been to a hockey game, there's some plexiglass barriers between not only circling the ice, but between the benches and the fans. And she was close enough to see, Nadia was close enough to see that one of the equipment managers for the Vancouver Canucks, his name was Brian Hamilton, had a really odd-shaped mole on his neck. It was very irregularly shaped, in fact. It was reddish-brown in color. I don't want to gross you out or anything like that, but she realized immediately, because she volunteers in a cancer ward, wants to be a med student, she immediately realized this could be a cancerous mole on this guy's neck. I've seen these things before. And so she was at the game with her parents, and she said, "Mom and Dad, should I tell this guy? I mean, is this like an invasion of his privacy? I mean, he probably already knows he's got this huge mole on his neck. But wait a minute, if he knows already, why hasn't he had it removed and, you know, had a biopsy done?" So she sort of, throughout the entire game, had this interior conversation. Should I tell him? Should I not? And she finally realized that he probably doesn't know. So at the end of the game, she had typed a message onto her iPhone, and she waved at this guy frantically, got his attention before he went into the locker room, and pressed her phone up against the glass. And the message on her phone said this: "The mole on the back of your neck is possibly cancerous. Please go see a doctor." So the words mole, cancer, and doctor she put in bright red type, just in case he didn't get the message. And he kind of looked at her and kind of absentmindedly rubbed his neck and sort of shook his head and said, "Oh, that's weird." And it kind of just kept going. And Nadia Popovich said, "Oh, man, that was probably a mistake. That was inappropriate. I shouldn't have done that." But in actuality, she probably saved his life. She probably saved Mr. Hamilton's life, because Brian Hamilton went home that night and he asked his partner — he's not married yet, got to get married, sanctify that relationship, Brian. So he asked his partner, "Hey, can you — I think her name is Julie — is there a mole on the back of my neck?" And she's like, "Yeah, that looks kind of weird." And so the next day he went back and asked the Vancouver Canucks team doctor, is this something I should be worried about?" And he's like, "Yeah, you should be." So he has the thing removed, biopsy results come in, and indeed, this 22-year-old fan, Nadia Popovich, was correct, and she had saved his life. And so this became a kind of a viral story. And as Brian Hamilton says today, "She pulled me out of a slow fire." It's kind of like being rescued from a burning building that's burning really, really slowly. Because the doctor, when he got the results of the biopsy back, Brian Hamilton, equipment manager for the Vancouver Canucks, the doctor said, "If you had ignored this mole for 4 years, if you just kind of let it go, you wouldn't be alive, because it's type 2 malignant melanoma. And thankfully, because it was detected early, they could easily remove it, easily treat him." And in fact, the doctor told Mr. Hamilton, "Hey, I got some good news and some bad news for you. The bad news is I'm going to diagnose you with cancer, but the good news is I'm going to cure you of cancer in the same phone call, because this is very treatable. And if you act now, you're going to be fine." So after he got this news, Brian Hamilton said, "I've got to find this girl who gave me the message at the hockey game. I have to thank her somehow." So he wrote a letter, and the Vancouver Canucks posted the letter on their official Twitter account. And it said, "To this woman I am trying to find, you changed my life, and now I want to find you so I can say thank you so very much. But I don't know who you are. I don't know where you're from. Well, here's the internet for you. It only took 3 hours after the Canucks posted this letter online. It only took 3 hours for the world to find Nadia Popovic. She was actually asleep at her home in Tacoma, Washington, and her mother. This woman, I think, not only is she going to be a great doctor, obviously, when she goes to med school, she might also be a very holy person, because apparently the reason why she was asleep during the daytime was because she worked overnight the night before at a suicide hotline crisis intervention location. So that's how she spent her New Year's Eve doing that. Wow, unbelievable. So she woke up and she had all these texts from her mom saying, man, the whole world is looking for you. And so she actually got to go to another game where the Canucks played Seattle once again, and she actually got to meet Brian Hamilton in person. Here's some audio of their reunion, or their union for the first time that they met each other.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, it's so nice to meet you. Are you okay with shaking hands?
Yes, okay.
Thank you so much
for reaching out.
Well, oh my gosh.
You.
I was so shocked when I heard about everything. Oh my goodness.
When you showed me your phone, I also said today I felt terrible because I was kind of like, okay.
I thought you already knew about
no,
it.
No, I
and
didn't.
I was like, oh no, he didn't want me to bring it up.
So I was like, well, that's weird.
Yeah.
And so that wasn't what I was expecting to see. And but then the next day I woke up and then I said to Jess, like, it was your effort and your persistence and the fact that you just didn't write it on your phone. Like, you wrote it the way you wrote it on your phone. I told Jess, like, I owe it to this person to get checked. Like, if she went this far, I don't know her. I don't know what she knows. I don't know anything about her. I need to get this checked.
Wow. That's incredible. That's incredible. And obviously this story, if you've been on Twitter, you might have heard about this, or on Facebook or something like that. It pretty much went viral. And after this meeting between the two of them, both of the teams combined, the Canucks and the Kraken, presented Nadia Popovic with a $10,000 scholarship to use for med school. That is a great story. That is a great story. I mean, and how providential, too. This idea that a future med student happened to be sitting close enough to the bench, happens to see this mole on this guy's neck, close enough to see it, and has the actual audacity to tell him about it. And this really resonates with me personally, too, because my wife did this for one of my relatives, probably saved this person's life. Same exact thing happened. She noticed that this person had a very strangely shaped mole on the forehead and said, that doesn't look right to me. You should really get that checked out. And this person means a lot to me. I'm not going to say who it is, but had spent a lot of time out in the sun. And back in the day, nobody knew about SPF and sunscreen and UV radiation, all that sort of stuff. And it was very common for people to just bake in the sun and get leathery skin and stuff. And hey, it's a badge of honor, right? You want to be bronze, right? Like George Hamilton or something. Anyways, but yeah, so this person went to the doctor. Sure enough, it was melanoma. And that's to be taken very seriously, because people don't think skin cancers are that serious, but they really can be life-threatening. It's the biggest organ in your body, your skin, obviously. And so please take that seriously, folks. And I don't know, maybe that story resonated with you a little bit. You can call in if you want to react to that, 888-914-9149. But Producer Lucas, you had an interesting application from this little piece, right?
Yeah, well, it's funny. I hadn't heard about this story, and when you shared it with me, I was like, wow, that's amazing. But what he said there in that audio clip, when he was like, you know, if this girl's going to go to this length to try and tell me about this, then I guess I owe it to her to at least get it checked out. And, you know, and yeah. I was like, what about if we did that with evangelization and sharing the Ooh. Faith? Like, if that's somebody, you know, like, what about if we were like, you know what, I'm going to go up to this person and tell them the gospel. And you know what, I don't care if it's embarrassing to me or whatever. Maybe that person will think you're nuts, but maybe they'll walk away thinking, you know, that person went to a pretty great length to just say that to me out of nowhere. Maybe I'll look into it, you know? So,
yeah.
Hey, why not try it?
This kind of relates to, I mean, we have a life-saving message, literally.
Yeah.
And it's a message that's salvation for your eternal soul. And yes, even if the body is healed from skin cancer, melanoma, whatever, The mortality rate's still 100% last time I checked. So eternal life is super key. And do we have the audacity, do we care enough about people to tell them about the gospel? And I'm not saying you have to do it in that way where, I mean, maybe God is calling you to stand on a street corner with a sandwich board saying, you know, the end of the world is nigh or whatever. I don't know. Maybe God is calling you to that. I know for me, what got me thinking about Jesus was when I was in university and these campus missionaries knocked on my door, cold call me. And it's not for everybody, but some people are called into this. But again, I think it goes back to, for most of us, it goes back to this whole angle of personal friendship and one-on-one relationships of trust that where you can kind of communicate that within that context. And anyways, but I do think, yeah, the idea of a stranger, why would the stranger care enough about me to say this? That there's something to that as well.
Yeah.
There's something to that as well. Well, lots to think about here, but we're going to take a quick break right now on the Cale Clark Show. But I really thought that was the best feel-good story so far of 2022, which is a very young year. And let's make it a good one in our Catholic lives. 888-914-9149. Cale Clark Show. Be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
This is The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Hey, welcome back to the program. 888-914-9149 is a toll-free line to call if you want to react to anything that you've heard to this point on The Cale Clark Show. But hey, you know what's happening today? Today is it's a very special birthday for a very special person. And a great supporter of Relevant Radio, I might add, as well. It is the 99th birthday of one Virginia McCaskey, and she is the owner of the Chicago Bears football team, the Monsters of the Midway. Her dad was George Halas, Papa Bear, one of the founders of the NFL, and of course, the coach, owner of the Chicago Bears. She is his daughter, and she owns the team. And not only that, she just loves Relevant Radio, and she's done so much to support our work over the years. So happy birthday to you, Mrs. McCaskey, and we're all praying for you. And by the way, I don't know Mrs. McCaskey, but I did drive past her house the last time I was in Chicago. I had some meetings at Relevant Radio, and one of the executives was showing me around some of the neighborhoods. And oh, that's Virginia McCaskey's house, by the way. I was tempted to ring the doorbell and ask for season tickets, but no. Maybe next time. But happy birthday, Mrs. McCaskey. And somebody who was almost as old as Mrs. McCaskey passed away last week, who was also a legend in the football world, John Madden. And you probably heard about this last Tuesday. He passed away at the age of 85. It's incredible. He was such a talented individual who, I mean, he was an everyman. He's the kind of guy that you'd want to have a beer with and watch football with. But people don't realize how intelligent John Madden really was. Anyways, NFL Films had a great retrospective of his life and career, which was quite varied. Here's a little clip.
Dick Stockton with John Madden.
Hi, everybody. I'm Vin Scully, along with John Madden.
Pat Summerall here with John Madden.
For 30 years, John Madden was the beloved dean of football analysts.
What a way to start a Super Bowl. That's what Cincinnati wants to do.
As the first sportscaster to work for all four major networks, Madden built a successful career with his colorful everyman approach.
Boom, you hit him. I mean, that's boom. Boom, right to the ground. Some people say, you know, they run in there and they collide or something. I mean, it hits in there, boom. That's what I say.
He makes a little basketball twist there and pivot, and boom, the ball's there right again between the 8 and the 9. Oh, is he happy?
While later generations remember his larger-than-life broadcast persona, it was as the coach of the Oakland Raiders that he first grabbed the spotlight. In 1969, the 32-year-old Madden became the NFL's youngest head coach.
Today feels like the second time in my life that I'm being carried off the shoulders of others. This has been the sweetest ride of them all.
And those words from John Madden were from his Hall of Fame induction speech. And The first time he was carried off on the shoulders of others, that was when the Raiders, and he was the coach of the Raiders. A lot of Raider fans out there. And his Raiders finally got over the top, won the Super Bowl in the 1976 season, and his players carried him off the field. He says he felt the same way at his Hall of Fame induction, because nobody gets to the pinnacle alone. But John Madden really did get to the pinnacle of really three different fields, at least three different fields. People forget that he had the highest winning percentage as a coach in NFL history. He won three out of every four games that he coached. That is better than Bill Belichick. It's better than Tom Landry. It's better than Don Shula. So many legends. But people forget about that. He's a Super Bowl winning coach. People forget because he had such a great career as a broadcaster. And there are a multitude of people living today who don't even know necessarily about that career, because they only know him from the multi-billion dollar industry that is the Madden football game, the Madden video game. And even today, there are Madden tournaments that people play in these video game tournaments for big bucks. A lot of people learned football from Madden. Madden was just a great teacher overall. And Brian Curtis wrote an article in The Ringer on the Ringer website. Here's another career that John Madden had that a lot of people don't know about. He was a professor. In 1979, after Madden quit as the head coach of the Oakland Raiders, he actually was hired by the University of California at Berkeley to teach a course that was called Man-to-Man Football. And all of his students were people who watch football on TV, but they wanted to understand how it actually worked. So what he used to do was stand in front of a board that was a little bit like the telestrator that he later made famous on television as an analyst. He would draw the X's and O's, and as he was explaining football plays, he would carefully look at the faces of his students. And he said, I wanted to see at what point I lost him. And so, take it from me, as somebody who does a lot of public speaking, and this is what's so different about radio. When I'm giving talks to a crowd, you know immediately whether people are into it or not, or whether they're, you know, checking their phone or falling asleep. I don't know on radio whether you're listening or not some of the times, but John Madden knew right away, this is too deep. It's not really connecting. So what he wanted to do is find a simple way to explain something that was very, very complex. And that's really what his genius was. He was a great teacher, whether it's through the Madden video game, or whether it was through coaching, or whether it was through broadcasting. He loved to teach. And when he was a coach, he only had three rules. Three rules. That was it. Number one, be on time. Number two, listen to what he's telling you. And number three, play like heck when I tell you to. Those are three pretty good rules for almost any profession, really, for life. Be on time, listen, and play like heck when you're called upon. Not bad, not bad. So, John Madden could have been a professional comedian. Again, most people, when he came into the broadcasting world, the most famous football announcer at the time was Howard Cosell. Remember Howard Cosell from Monday Night Football? And he was very intelligent. Cosell was very erudite. He could give you some $5 words at the drop of a hat. But Madden really brought things back to, it made you feel again like you were having a beer with him in a bar or something like that, just watching the game. It was really, really down to earth. But he was very, very, very funny. Had a book that was called One Knee Equals 2 Feet. And that was his way of explaining, hey, when a receiver catches the ball, comes down in bounds, it's either with 2 feet in bounds or a knee will work, or a bum or anything, any other part of your body, you're in bounds. And he used a lot of humor. He was definitely the funniest guy on TV. He would say things like, I don't understand dark chocolate. It's like they got halfway to milk chocolate and they just quit. He would tell people, hey, if you're traveling, don't ever sleep on the side of the hotel bed that's next to the phone. Why? Because every businessman who's ever stayed in that room, that's where he sat his bum, because that's where he sits and talks on the phone. Sleep on the other side. Just you know, kind of funny stuff like that. So I don't know. A lot of people will miss John Madden, and he was really almost universally loved. But the way he tried to explain a complex game like football in a very simple way, it's kind of what we tried to do here on Relevant Radio. We tried to take the faith, we try to package it, explain it in a way that people can digest it, can take something from it, and really live it out in their everyday life. And that's what we've got to do. That's what we've got to do. We all can do it. We've got the ability to understand it. We've got the ability to live it, share it, and explain it to others. That's what the Cale Clark Show is all about. Faith Explained, all the other programs that we have here on Relevant Radio. All right. So we are down to less than 30 seconds in the program. I want to thank producer Lucas for another stellar job today. Appreciate that. Patrick Alog took your phone calls. Got some great stuff coming up. Speaking of the Faith Explained program tomorrow, check it out. 12:30 Central, right after the Mass. We call it Class After Mass. If you've ever asked the question, God, what in the world are you up to in my life? You're going to want to tune in tomorrow, because people far better than you and I have asked that question. Moses himself asked that question directly to God. What in the world are you doing? And God wasn't offended by that. And he had an answer for him. So check that out tomorrow, 12:30. And I'll be back tomorrow, 5 p.m. Central, 3 p.m. Pacific on Relevant Radio. It's the Cale Clark Show. It's been a slice. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.